the evening, we broke our pattern and did so for good reason, and talked about Hebrew poetry and how it is different. There is no rhyme of sound. There is rhyme of meaning. And we spent a whole hour with that on the BFT series. And therefore, to keep pace with that, I'd like to do a BFT this morning, not BLT, BFT, Bible Fast Track, on the book of Job. Let's find it. We are turning to probably the oldest book in the Bible and one of the most instructive because it deals with the problem of undeserved suffering. People always ask, what did Job do that was so wrong? And they try to get Job as proud or something like that. Job didn't do anything wrong. Job, I believe, was a perfectly good man, and these testings and trials didn't come along to make Job humble. Job simply faced this question. Why do the godly suffer? And may I answer this way? God never, 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 never tells Job. God just says, trust me. Oh, that's tough, isn't it? I don't mind suffering for certain things that I know I've deserved, but all these things that I can't find any connection with is, what did I do? And we always ask that, don't we? If the kids go wrong, what did I do wrong? Who said you did anything wrong? Or this happens, why me? Or why do these terrible things seem to happen to people who do love the Lord? And the book of Job is all about that. Now, we often handle this question, well, you do not know why God brings suffering in your life. But sometime in heaven, God will turn on a video. And you'll see all the little tiny subplots. And someday you'll breathe easy because you'll know what all of the suffering that you went through was all about. Hogwash. God is not obligated to show a video of why He does anything. And I'm going to ask Corey to read a little article, and I rarely do this, but an article on this subject of how Pollyannish we get about, now, you know, pat the hand, Romans 8:28 is still in the book. God works all things together for good, and your sister and brother and mom and dad all got killed, and you've got six other sisters in critical condition, but just brace up, you know. God works all things together for good to them that love the Lord. And you may not see it now, but in the life to come, it'll all be very clear. And I add again, hogwash. God is not obligated to any such thing. And someone, I do not know who the author is, but someone wrote on this many years ago, and I'd like for Corey to read it to you. Listen to it.
This article is called What Job Saw. I've never much liked scripture wall plaques because they trap God's living words in a sentimental thicket of leaves and flowers, often with cute animals peeking out for good measure. This plaster of Paris process happens verbally as well. Some verses are hauled out as platitudes so often that one has visions of scrolling vines as soon as the words are uttered. Who, after suffering a loss, great or small, hasn't heard Romans 8:28 murmured and much hand-patting? The problem isn't that the verse isn't appropriate. It's those curling vines. All things are working for the good of those who love God, but in our Pollyannish, self-centered way, we take it to mean that sooner or later God will show us the reason for our suffering. We interpret this verse as a promise that the pain will disappear when we finally are able to gasp at the beauty of the brocade God is weaving of our life's experiences. This is a romantic thought, but is it biblical? I don't believe God always shows us why we had to undergo certain things, my friend asserted adamantly. Well, maybe not on earth, but surely when we get to heaven. My egocentric picture of heaven had us all watching videotapes of our lives, sighing with satisfaction as God explained all the subplots. No, she insisted. It's enough that God told us that he's working all things out for his glory. It's all under his sovereign control, and nowhere is he obligated to explain. Now, I believe she's right. A too individualized seeking for good in our personal lives causes us to miss the grandeur of God's corporate purpose for his people. Hebrews 11 tells us that none of the great saints listed received what had been promised. The consummation of the good that God was working through their suffering did not come until generations later. Sometimes God does let individuals see how the suffering in their lives is bringing about good. Joseph could tell his brothers, "It was not you who sent me here, but God." As he distributed grain to his family and all Egypt, he recognized God's plan in tragic events of many years prior. But Job's only answer was a torrential description of God's inscrutable majesty. Job never was given an explanation for his suffering, but something better instead. "My ears had heard of you, but now my eyes have seen you." The sight of God burns away every other concern.
Yeah, good. Job 42, verse 5. It's where the little article quoted from. Having gone through all of this suffering, he says in verse 5, "I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees thee." And that really wraps it all up as far as the book of Job is concerned. Now, as you know, we pass out little laminated cards for each BFT, and we have them down here at the front. If you want one, pick it up. And on one side, as you know, we have the title of the book, Job, the Book of Undeserved Suffering. And then the key verse, or a good memory verse. And this has wonderful concepts in it. It's Job 13, verse 15. And since we have them down front, let's look at that verse in our text. Job 13, verse 15. Unfortunately, this is one of those verses that we quote only part of it, and consequently miss a great deal. Job 13, verse 15. What part of this verse do we always quote? "Though he slay me, I will hope in him." End verse. No, that's not it at all. Notice, "Nevertheless, in spite of my unlimited trust in him, I will argue my life or my ways before him." Now that gives us a wonderful balance. Do we trust the Lord with all of our heart? Yes, we do. Should we be able to say, "Though, Lord, you slay me, I still will trust you. But God, I want to argue with you." I mean, an unthinkable thing? Argue with God? Why, sure. Haven't you ever gotten mad at God? Haven't you ever asserted that he made a mistake? Come on now, don't look pious. Haven't you ever in your mind said, "God, you don't know what you're doing. You shouldn't do this." In fact, isn't many times that's what prayer is? It's arguing with God. "Lord, look, things are going this way. Please stop them." And you have the audacity to argue with God. Now, we'll get to this a little bit more in the book of Psalms, but one of the characteristics of Psalms, and the poetic books, really, that makes it so great is David loves to jew God. "You sell it to me for a quarter? How about it? 20 cents. Sell it to me for 20 cents? Oh, come on. Bring it down a little bit. How about a dime? And that's what I mean by Jewing God. And so he will write in this particular manner. And it may seem shocking to you, but it shouldn't. And if you grasp it, it'll increase your intimacy with God. And it goes something like this. And I'm paraphrasing what we'll look at in the book of Psalms. Lord, you know, I'm about to die. My enemies are right outside the door. They're ready to sink their spear in me. I know I'm almost dead. However, God, may I call something to your attention? You say, oh, come on. Yes, God loves us to call things to his attention. And David will say, look, there's a problem here. If I end up in the ground, in the grave, I won't be around to praise you anymore, will I? And men that I have proclaimed Christ and I've proclaimed the character of God to, they won't hear anything more from these lips. If I die, God, you're the loser. Now, does that strike you as irreverent? Well, if it does, the whole book of Psalms is irreverent. Because as we'll see later, and as we see in this verse, Job is saying, do I trust? Yes, I trust. Do I know he will do what is right? Yes, I know that. But that doesn't mean I won't argue with him. That doesn't mean I won't say to God that shouldn't be going this way. Does the Bible regard God as personal or impersonal? Think to many, many believers, God is a very impersonal God. I have many times, and I don't... You ever say something that you mean, but you don't mean? You know what I mean? You know, I understand this, but and I know it, and I'm sure it's true, but I really don't see it. I remember John Walvoord, president of Dallas Seminary, had a son who went through seminary, did a good job, was going to the mission field, was a medical doctor, went through all of his training for medicine and for theology. The night of graduation, got in his car, wasn't six blocks away. Automobile accident, and he was killed. Now, did God know what's best? Yes, God knows what's best. Do I see it? No, I don't. No, I don't. To me, that was a bad move on God's part. And I don't mean this to be irreverent. I'm just saying something inside of me says, I can't put that together. And this is the book of Job. Job says, why do I suffer? And God never tells him. So our memory verse out of Job is this. Though he slay me, I will hope in him. He has all of my trust. Nevertheless, I will argue my case before him. God is sovereign. He's in control. He can be trusted. But that doesn't mean we're all blocks of stoic rock. I mean, the Lord just took my wife or my husband away from me, and Christians say, rejoice! God knows best. I'm not going to rejoice. I'm going to cry. And I'm going to feel it. And I'm going to let it out. And I probably will yell at God. Might even swear at God. But God is personal. And he's not a rock. I know he can be trusted. And yet, I will argue my case with him. And I think many, many times, learning to trust the Lord is really saying, learn to be a stoic. Don't let anything faze you. God is in control. And I know that God is in control. But I am also human. I have feelings. I have emotions. And you can get into a very unhealthy lifestyle as a Christian when you feel that you must face life's events as a Stoic and feel nothing except to be sure to keep the chin up around the fellow Christian. Don't let your emotions be known. And the Bible does not demand that at all. I think one of the greatest things I ever learned was what has been called the faith rest technique. Of under pressures, you rest in the Lord and you trust in the Lord. And that is a wonderful, wonderful concept. And it's true. But don't be afraid of emotion. Don't be afraid that God does not want you to argue. God loves to hear you say, without ego, I hope, that, Lord, if I die, I can't teach my Sunday school class anymore. We were in a Hyatt incident when the Skywalks came down. And I couldn't help but think that night, boy, it was on a Saturday, and I was all ready to teach on Sunday. And I couldn't help but think, I almost didn't teach anymore. It was almost all over. And I know the Lord had His hand in it. And yet, I began to realize I'm human, I'm limited, and this is part of the point of the book of Job. Now, let's take the book and give an outline to it. How can we put Job together? The book of Job falls easily into three parts. They are all historical. And there are three historical elements in the book of Job. Number one, there is the historical prologue. Jane, you're my editor. I forget. That's right. It's dialogue that is no U-E, right? Oh, it can. A prologue. Prologue. Chapter 1, verse 1 through 2:13. Historical prologue. Now, what is the content of the historical prologue? Well, the basis of the prologue is a dialogue. And the dialogue is one that goes on between God and Satan. They dialogue, and this all occurs in heaven. A dialogue between God and Satan that takes place in heaven. And it affects Job on earth. Now, it's important to note in grasping the message of Job that Job never knew about this conversation. He didn't know what happened. I don't think he ever knew. So Job knows nothing about chapter 1 and chapter 2. And so let's go to it and notice the behind the scenes. And here's the way the book is going to go. I am going to tell you in great detail what happens to Job down on earth. Job knew all about it. He went through it all. He felt it all. He was there. And that begins with the next section. But before we ever go to that, God says this whole thing that happened down on earth was a result of a conversation in heaven that God and Satan had, and Job knew nothing about. Let me paraphrase it. Satan says to God, I have a thesis. Nobody on earth has ever, does now, or ever will love you for who you are. man loves you for the blessings you give him. Now, let me ask you about that principle. Is that pretty good? You've got a friend, a very good friend. And we like to be heroes and say, I like my friend just for who they are. Well, that's nice. And I hope that's present, and I hope I do like my friends for who they are. But there is a line, isn't there? What are you going to do if your friend comes up to you and says, you said this about me, in your face? Still a friend? Remember, you love them for who they are, not what they do. And we know good and well we don't have any friends like that. Even as a matter of fact, you're not married to anyone like that, are you? Ideally, I'm married to Betty because of who she is, and I try to think that. And I am married to her, and I hope she thinks it's for who I am. But I know something. I know that if I go home and say, wow, you know, I met this little blonde chick today at lunch. She was so cute. Neither one of us came back to work in the afternoon. We just walked in the park and had a great time. Can you women give me a response if you hear this from your husband? Remember, you love him for who he is. Now, there's a lot of what we do, and so God gives a very, Satan gives a very logical argument. And look at Job chapter 1 and verse 9. Then Satan answered the Lord, does Job fear you for no reason? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands. Possessions have increased in the land. But I tell you what, if you put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, he'll swear in your face. And that is the thesis of Satan that is set forth in the prologue of the book of Job. Is there anybody who loves God for who he is, or do we love God only for what he does to us? Now, God says, well, Satan, you're wrong. There is a man now there named Job, and I will take away his possessions, and everything will fall apart. And so you have the historical prologue that sets up the basic question. Now, this is followed by a historical dialogue. Historical dialogue. By the way, how would you like to have been Job? God and Satan have had the conversation. There is there's no one on earth that doesn't, if you take away everything they've got, they will not love you anymore. And hear your name. He wouldn't say this, but he said, yeah, I tell you what, let's just put this thing to the test. And I think I will pick out Chester. I'll take away his family. Boy, we just acquired through Greg a dog. He's a chow lab, or a lab chow. And you know how labs are wonderful, affectionate dogs. That tail just, never stops. And if you feel bad, Sandy will lay down beside you, put his head on your arm, just as though, yeah, I understand and I'm here. And ridiculous. I've had thoughts. What are we going to do when Sandy dies? Well, that's a little thing. Suppose God took away your kids through sudden death all at once? Everything you own is gone all at once. Your health suddenly goes down the tube. You are nothing but a mass of boils. I understand a little bit of that because I remember on one vacation, if you've never had this, it's quite an experience. I got sunburned lips on the East Coast and sores all across. I mean, people would see you coming at 50 feet and walk on the other side of the street. You'd have to yell out, "Leper, leper." Well, Job was boils from head to foot. And God said, "Satan, you can touch everything about Job, his family, his life, his property, everything about him, except his life." And so in the historical dialogue, this begins to happen. And it's found in chapter 3, verse 1. 3:1 through 42:6. Now, everything is taken away from Job, and here in this section of Job, we're going to talk about it. And so, we have three key things. We have, number one, the key question. And the key question is very simple. Why does Job suffer? Why? It's all undeserved. Why does Job suffer? Look at chapter 1. And you have a little description of Job. Beginning at verse 1, there was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. And that man was blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. What was wrong with Job? Well, I think it's very clear at the very opening of the book, God is saying there was nothing wrong with Job. That doesn't mean he was sinless. But as far as his relationship to God, everything was fine. Everything was fine. And, in addition, he was prosperous. Verse 2. 7 sons, 3 daughters born to him. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, and so forth, so that he was the greatest of all men of the East. A very wealthy man in terms of family and in terms of possession. So I think our opening statement is, there was nothing wrong with Job. Then we ask a question, and there it is. Why does God suffer? Why are some horrible... Why is Job going to leave it all or lose it all? Was it something in him? No. He was answering a question asked by Satan. There's no man on the earth that will not swear in your face if you take everything away from him. Now, be honest. And I know that church is not a very easy place to be honest because all of our friends are here. And I need to look spiritually mighty in front of all of you. But I'm going to be honest. I think if God took everything away from me, I'd say, "God damn you." Now, I know you wouldn't. I'm just confessing as sinner that I am. Because I've seen God do some things in the lives of people, in my own life, that I did not like at all. I mean, start it off. You go out with your keys. Your car's gone. You write a check. Your bank account is empty. You want to tell your wife about it. She's dead. Well, I need some comfort from the kids. They're dead too. I need to go home and there is no home. Well, I have savings. It's gone. I have great wealth. It's gone. Everything that Job had was gone. And Satan stands in the corner and says, I'm just waiting for Job to swear at God. And you know what? Job doesn't do it. He doesn't do it. And even his wife says to him, what? Job, get it over with. Curse God and die. He said, no, I won't do it. And he proves to be a man that trusts the Lord. Who else went through that similar situation? Jesus said to Peter, Satan has desired you that he might sift you like wheat. Is it possible that Satan has talked to God about you? And said, Tinley, you're always looking and listening, and so you get used as the illustration. Are you prepared to lose everything? And I know, in theory, we ought to say, oh, yes, as long as it doesn't happen. But the question comes up is, why does Job suffer? Now, the key speakers, the key question, and now the key speakers in Job. And I'm not going to write their names out, but just simply call attention to them in chapter 2, verse 11 through 13. Now when Job's three, I believe we need quotes here. Now when Job's three, quote, end quote, friends heard of all of his adversity that had come down upon him, they came each one from his own place, Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, and they made an appointment together to come to sympathize with him and to comfort him. And they lifted up their eyes at a distance and did not recognize him. They raised their voices and wept. And each of them tore his robe and they threw dust over their heads toward the sky. Then they sat down on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights with no one speaking a word to him, for they saw that his pain was very great. And in the following context, Job says, I will trust him, but I curse the day I was born. And he allows his emotions to be vented. But we'll find out that these speakers found in 2:11 through 13, call friends, will make a common error. The key question, why does Job suffer? The key speakers, these three men, and they all make a key error. The answer to the question, why does Job suffer? His sin. And they are so locked on that, that what happens is with this theology or this doctrine in their mind, that you can only suffer because of sin. And if you've suffered, you got to find a sin in your life. And that is their theological bias, that is their belief, but that is an error. Because God is going to say, this is not the reason at all. So, here's what happens. Because of their error, and move from the question, why does he suffer? To the erroneous answer, because of sin. We end chapter 1, or the prologue, with consolation. And notice they certainly start that way. When you end up chapter 2, they are sitting down on the ground. They are not speaking. They are there to see his pain and feel his pain. And because of their wrong doctrine, consolation with chapter 2 becomes something different. Consolation becomes condemnation. And the Job whom they seek to console, they end up condemning, because after all, sin is the only cause. Well, we then follow with the third part of the book of Job, which we will call the historical epilogue. Prologue, dialogue, epilogue. And for memory purposes, if you wish to follow in the Bible fast track, we do this for every book we do. You have here on the back of the card the memory verse, and then on the back the three parts, prologue, dialogue, and epilogue. And in the epilogue, you have two things. Number one, you have the rebuke of his friends. And the rebuke of Job's friends begins in 42:7-9. Let's look at that. 42:7-9. By the way, how many of you remember our doing the book of Job? You know when that was? The first lesson. January 7th, 1984. Seem like it's been that long? Okay, 7 through 9. It came about after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, "My wrath is kindled against you and against your two friends, because you have not spoken of me what is right as my servant Job has," and therefore he condemns them in the passage. So the epilogue is the friends get rebuked, and the epilogue is that Job gets restored. Two things then, rebuke and restoration. And the restoration begins in 42:10. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends, and the Lord increased all that Job had twofold. And therefore, God brings him through. And the whole point is simply this. What did Job do? Let me read another little quote that I think helps a great deal. "We cannot understand the meaning of many trials. God does not explain them." And may I stop right there and say, it's not like your pastor has often illustrated. You look at a piece of tapestry, and down underneath are all these rags, and you can't see a pattern. But you turn it upside, and there's a wonderful pattern. Well, that's true, but the catch is, are you going to see that pattern in this life? I don't think so. "We cannot understand the meaning of many trials. God does not explain them." Can you think of certain things that have happened to you under the sovereignty of God that you can't even begin to explain? They're still a mystery to you? Well, here's why. To explain a trial would be to destroy its object, which is that of calling forth simple faith and implicit obedience. If we knew why the Lord sent us this or that trial, it would thereby cease to be a trial, either of faith or of patience. And you will admit, as a believer, Isn't life filled with question marks? Feel free to argue. Job did. But he trusted, and he trusted implicitly and completely in the Lord. Now let me suggest in our closing 10 minutes, how did other biblical writers see Job? How did they look at him? And I want to look at two places. Look at Ezekiel chapter 14. Ezekiel 14. Verses 14 and 20. Here is a prophet coming many, many centuries after Job. And he has a viewpoint on Job, and he has something he wants to say about this particular man. And so in verse 14, even though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in its midst by their own righteousness, what was wrong with Job? Nothing. He was a righteous man. They could only deliver themselves, declares the Lord. And so Ezekiel looks in biblical history and says, I would pick out three men that are classic cases of righteousness. Job, Daniel, and Noah. Look at James 5:11. James 5:11. And James has something to say about Job. Behold, we count those blessed who endured. You have heard of the endurance of Job. You do know the word endurance, do you not? Can someone guess what endurance is, or perseverance, or stick-to-itiveness? What is it? Hupomene. The word we ought to learn and know, it's the word hupa, and it is compound, we'll put a slash right there, and mane. And this simply means under. That's easily remembered, like a hypodermic needle gets under your skin. Mane means to stay or remain. It's the ability to remain under. Hupa mane. I just found this week something about hupa mane that I think is helpful. It means to remain instead of flee. To remain as against running. Look at Acts 17. Acts 17. Notice in verse 14 you've got running and remaining. That's really the two halves of the verse. Those that ran, those that remained. And immediately, the brethren sent Paul out to go as far as the sea. He fled. But, latter part, Silas and Timothy hupomened. They didn't run. They stayed. Is there anything... I hardly need to say this comment, is what do you want to do in the face of difficulties and pressures? Get away from them. Run. Some people live their whole life that way, maritally. It's rough with this woman, so I run. And now I found a cute little thing who will replace her. Until that gets tough, and then what do? You run again. And many people have run and run and run and run. How many will say, boy, I've got lots of pressures. I just need to finish it. Everybody here has said it. I need to get away. Well, there's truth to that. There are times when you need to get away. But do you mean that life is easier at the lake than here? It may give you a little break, but you know, life at the lake will eventually become life at home. And life with this person, if you run from it, will become misery with another person. And some people do nothing but live to change their circumstances. And that's never it. Now, there are times, granted, that you need to take a break. But this is not basically the answer as far as life is concerned. So, God, or Job, is a man whose example is that of suffering. Now, in closing, let me give four suggested answers to undeserved suffering. Number one, principle. God is worthy of total devotion apart from the blessings He gives. Think of that. God is deserving of devotion apart from the blessings He bestows. And as I say that, Satan is saying, there is no such person. And as we are saying this, we are seeing in front of us in the book of Job the proof that man can love God for who He is in the fullest sense of the word. Number two, God allows the believer to experience undeserved suffering in order to build your faith muscle. I do not know why. I do not need to know why. I know who. I never said that before. That's pretty good. Let me do it again. I do not know why. I have no idea why. It's all a big contradiction. But I know who. Is that enough? I remember my parents used to use that on me, and boy, it'd make me so mad as a kid. Look, you wouldn't understand why I say no, but trust me, I'm dead. And oh, that would, something inside of me would just rise up against that. But that's what God often says. Look, you little pea brain, you wouldn't know if I explained. So why should I waste divine breath on you? Trust me. Just trust me. We glibly go over the attributes, don't we? God is love, limitless love. Nothing can be added to it. Nothing we can do can diminish it. Do you believe that? God is God. And one of the things that we lack so much today in our teaching, I believe in churches, is it's all me-centered. You got a big water boy up there in the sky, and he can't wait to pour blessing on you. Can we just appreciate God is God? Think about it. No limit to His love. No limit to His knowledge. And by the way, aren't you glad that God is the only person in the world that is omniscient and knows everything? What if your friends knew everything? Oh my, in big trouble. But there are times in life when you just relax. God is God. I do not know what in blazes is going on. But that doesn't mean God is tottering on His throne. God knows. And that may seem glib, but really that's a bottom line that Job had to learn. I go through all of this. I don't know why I suffer, but my eyes are open. I see You. I just read about a good friend of mine in college. His name is Elmer Lappin. And I remember Elmer not only as being a friend, but he had been in the Korean War, and both legs were shot off at the knee. And we pushed Elmer to all of his classes. And he wanted so bad to serve the Lord in some way, and yet we thought, Elmer, you'll never stand behind a pulpit without a chair. Someone will always have to put, poor Elmer, poor guy. I just read recently that Elmer died in Arizona, and as far as they could trace, they said, we have found that Elmer led at least 5,000 students at the University of Arizona to Christ. Handicapped? I forget her name, but the lady, was it Amy Carmichael? Who, as a little child, a doctor made a mistake, and he put something in her eyes that destroyed them, burned them out. She sued the doctor. No, she didn't. She took it as the hand of God, and she said, I'm so glad I'm blind. Because if I hadn't been struck blind, I would have never seen. And what she meant is that very often, and isn't this often the truth, that under pressure, under adversity, when things weren't going well, for the first time you begin to look up instead of out or in, and you begin to learn to trust Him. Third observation, God's wisdom sees factors infinitely beyond what we can ever see. Our perspective is earthbound. God's is not. Fourth, God operates His universe under an eternal plan. We operate within the framework of our own lives only. It may be trite. Remember what the poet Cooper said? Behind a frowning providence, God hides a smiling face. And this is the message of Job. Job did not know why, but Job found out who, and that was good enough. And that's why he is a man of such righteous character and a man of example of hanging in there. Now, this is the end of our fast track because we're coming up to 1 hour. However, since it's been so long, give me one time tonight, will you, to go a little further in Job, because it is so instructive that I think we need it. And then we'll be back to fast track Psalms on Wednesday and back to Acts next Sunday morning. And now, Father, we're thankful for the privilege of looking from ourselves to You, from our needs to You, from our wants to You. And help us not to be such me-centered people, but centered in the only place where stability comes, the only place where there is no disappointment. And that is in the very character of God Himself. We thank You for this in Christ's name. Amen.